I'd like to start the sermon today by asking the technicians in the back to play a song. I think this is a good introduction to the subject that I would like for us to look at in the Bible today. So if we can go ahead and have them roll that song, and they're going to, I think, put the lyrics up on the screens for you to follow along if you'd like to do that. I found that a very thought-provoking song. A lot of interesting things to mull over and think about in the lyrics there. I'm sure that wasn't the first time that many of you have heard that song. We're in country music region here, and anyway, so I'm sure you've heard that Tim McGraw song before. I'm sure as you think about those lyrics and we think about that topic that we're going to discuss a little bit today, I'm sure that a number of you have probably come face-to-face with a medical condition that put you face-to-face with questions of your own mortality, or perhaps you had to come to grips with that with a loved one, the possibility that the end of a physical existence might be very close, and perhaps, in fact, it was very close. Please, I need to make a disclaimer as we start the sermon. I'm not suggesting that you take up skydiving, rodeo riding, or that you should start climbing mountains in the Rockies, but the Bible does tell us that there is wisdom in considering how short our lives truly are as human beings. And that's really the topic that I would like to talk about today. There is also wisdom, the Bible tells us, in living each day of our lives in the light of that understanding, that we only have so much time. And in fact, we really don't have very much time. No matter who we are, no matter how young or old we are, in the great scheme of things, we actually have very little time. I would like for us to look in 2 Kings chapter 20, at a time when King Hezekiah, one of the good kings of Judah, faced the question of his own mortality. In fact, he was told that he was just about to die. And it's a rather interesting example from Hezekiah's life because he was given a reprieve. And not only was he given a reprieve, but we have a rather lengthy reaction from him that he had written down about the changes that it made in the way he thought about life as a result of this. So in 2 Kings chapter 20, starting in verse 1, it says, "In those days Hezekiah was sick and near death, and Isaiah the prophet, the son of Amoz, went to him and said to him, 'Thus says the Lord, set your house in order, for you shall die.'" And not only that, but you shall not live either. There's a little bit of overkill, we might say, in some of these. He wanted to make sure that was very clear. "And what did Hezekiah do? He turned his face toward the wall, and he prayed the Lord, saying, 'Remember now, O Lord, I pray, how I have walked before you in truth and with a loyal heart, and I've done what was good in your sight.' And Hezekiah wept bitterly." Those are difficult moments. "Then it happened, before Isaiah had gone out into the middle court, that a word of the Lord came to him, saying, 'Return and tell Hezekiah, the leader of my people, thus says the Lord, the God of David your father, I have heard your prayer, I have seen your tears.'" He does that. He hears our prayers and he sees our tears. "Surely I will heal you. On the third day you shall go up to the house of the Lord. And I will add to your days 15 years, and will deliver you and this city from the hand of the king of Assyria. And I will defend this city for my own sake and for the sake of my servant David." It's actually Isaiah who preserved Hezekiah's response or his reaction to this close call that he had with mortality at that time. Isaiah chapter 38, if you want to turn there with me. I think you'll find this interesting. I certainly did, to see Hezekiah's response. Isaiah chapter 38, starting in verse 9. In fact, the part that we just read in 2 Kings 20 is repeated in the first verses of this chapter. So it's actually recorded in two different places in the Bible. And here is Hezekiah's response. Verse 9, having mulled this over, having thought about the experience, these are his conclusions. "This is the writing of Hezekiah, king of Judah, when he had been sick and recovered from his illness. I said, in the prime of my life, I shall go to the gates of Sheol." There's some shock. This is not supposed to happen at this time. We all have certain expectations about how long our lives are going to be, and sometimes those expectations are met, but sometimes they're not. "I am deprived of the remainder of my years." He felt he should have had more. He had certain expectations about that. "I said, I shall not see Yah, the Lord, in the land of the living. I shall observe man no more among the inhabitants of the world." He starts reflecting on the value of friendship. "I'm not going to have that fellowship with other human beings. This is going to come to an end. My lifespan is gone, taken from me like a shepherd's tent. I have cut off my life like a weaver. A weaver just trims off a thread at the end. When they get to the end of it, cut that and move on with something else. And he said, that's what's going to happen to my life. He cuts me off from the loom. From day into night, you make an end of me. I have considered until morning. So some sleepless nights while he's contemplating his own mortality and the fact that an end might be near. Like a lion, so he breaks all my bones. There is pain and discomfort sometimes involved in this. From day until night, you make an end of me. Pain and fear that we feel in times like that. Like a crane or a swallow, so I chattered. I mourned like a dove. My eyes fail from looking upward. O Lord, I'm oppressed. Undertake for me. What shall I say? He has spoken to me. God's answer came to him. And he himself has done it. And notice this. I shall walk carefully in all my years. He's going to take greater care with the way he lives his life now. His priorities have shifted. Perhaps they've changed radically as a result of realizing, I don't have as much time as I thought I was going to have. Or this could all end in a moment. So I'm going to walk carefully now all the years of my life. And in the bitterness of my soul, he's going to walk in a calm, submissive way in his life, taking great care to do what is most important. O Lord, by these things men live, and in these things is the life of my spirit. So you will restore me and make me live. Verse 17 is rather striking too. Indeed, it was for my own peace that I had great bitterness. There was a peace that came to Hezekiah, having faced the situation. He learned wisdom. He learned something about the priorities that he should have first in his life. He learned from that experience, and he said it gave him peace to have faced it. But you have lovingly delivered my soul from the pit of corruption. You have cast all my sins behind your back. You have forgiven my mistakes, and God does that. Sheol cannot thank you. Death cannot praise you. Those who go down into the pit cannot hope for your truth. The living man, he shall praise you as I do this day. The father shall make known your truth to the children. Not only did he want to remember what he had learned from this experience, but he said, I'm going to make sure to pass this wisdom down to my children so that they can understand this optic, this way of looking at life, so that they can reorganize their priorities as well. The Lord was ready to save me. Therefore, we will sing my songs with stringed instruments all the days of our life in the house of God. Some commentators suggest that this was, that Hezekiah had these words set to music as a sort of song, and that he would have it played on the anniversary of his recovery every year as a reminder to him and to his family and to his court and his entourage about the important lessons that he had learned from this. He changed his point of view when he realized how short a time he had. And it is true, we know even from the experience of people living today, not necessarily in the church even, but people who face the possibility of death will tell you that it focuses your attention like nothing else will. Veterans of wars who've been in combat never forget those moments when they realize that every second could be their last. Moses also contemplated this truth about thinking about how limited our time is. Turn with me to Psalm 90, if you would. We often think of the Psalms as being written by David, and most of them were either written or collected by David. But we do have Psalms written by others as well. And Psalm 90 is apparently the oldest of all the Psalms. It was written by Moses, and it was collected into this collection of Psalms, no doubt by David. So this is one of the, if not the oldest, of the Psalms. And it was possibly written, it seems likely that it was written right after the sin of the Israelites when they rebelled against God, when the spies came back from the promised land with an evil report. And God said, very well, you don't trust me, you lack faith, this generation is going to wander in the desert until it dies. And it's not going to go in to the promised land, the next generation will. And you can see why that seems a likely time for the writing of this psalm as we read a few of the verses here. Let's start in verse 1. Prayer of Moses, the man of God. Lord, you have been our dwelling place in all generations. Before the mountains were brought forth, or ever you had formed the earth and the world, even from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. You turn man to destruction and say, return, O children of men. For 1,000 years in your sight are like yesterday when it is past. And that's very different from our experience. Like a watch in the night, you carry them away like a flood. They're like sheep. In the morning, they are like grass which grows up. In the morning, it flourishes and grows up. In the evening, it is cut down and withers. We have been consumed by your anger, and by your wrath we are terrified. You have set our iniquities before you, our secret sins in the light of your countenance. For all our days have passed away in your wrath. We finish our years like a sigh. The days of our lives are 70 years, and if by reason of strength they are 80 years, yet their boast is only labor and sorrow. For it is soon cut off, and we fly away. Who knows the power of your anger? For as the fear of you, so is your wrath. So, verse 12, this is kind of the verse around which the whole psalm turns. So teach us to number our days, that we may gain a heart of wisdom. Teach us to number our days, that we may have a heart of wisdom. What does it mean to number our days? Can we truly number our days? None of us really knows the exact number of days we're going to have. We can't predict that in advance. But one thing we can say is no matter how many days, whether it's 70 years or 80 years, or if someone has an accident earlier, or whether they manage to go on longer than 80, in the great scheme of things, that is nothing compared to eternity. We really have a very short amount of time, even if things work out in the best way we can imagine it, in this physical life. Moses himself lived to be 120. Yet, as he wrote here, life was labor and sorrow. There was a lot of that in there for Moses, as we all have our lot of labor and sorrow in life. David also was one who reflected on the brevity of life. He was a soldier from his youth. David saw men die in battle on many occasions, and he came very close himself on more than one occasion. He said to Jonathan at one point when Saul was after him, he said, "There is but a step between me and death." David knew he was on the edge, and if he made a wrong decision or things went a wrong direction, it would be over for him in an instant. And David also reflected on this. In Psalm 39, for example, we can see some of his reflections on this topic. Psalm 39. Psalm 39, verse 1. A psalm of David. I said, "I will guard my ways, lest I sin with my tongue. I will restrain my mouth with a muzzle while the wicked are before me. I was mute with silence. I held my peace even from good, and my sorrow was stirred up." But David's talking about a situation where he saw something that seemed very unfair to him in life. The wicked were prospering, and he was having all sorts of problems. And he had to bite his tongue to complain, to stop complaining, or not to complain about how unfair the situation was. And I'm sure you've experienced situations like that in your life, as I have. We come confronted with a situation, we say, "Well, that just doesn't seem fair. That dirty rat things are going great for him, and look where I am. That's not fair." And David said, at times like that, it's best just to bite your tongue. Don't say something you're going to regret later on, which we probably all have done. I know I have. My heart was hot within me. I was musing. While I was musing, the fire burned. He was upset. Then I spoke with my tongue, "Lord, make me to know my end. And what is the measure of my days, that I may know how frail I am?" That was a very wise thing to pray in that circumstance. He got his eyes off the fact that the dirty rat is flourishing here and I'm having a hard time. This isn't fair. He got his mind onto something else, which is, I have a really short space of time to walk the earth, and I have more important things to do than tell God how he's supposed to run his universe. Make me to know my end. Help me think about that. What is the measure of my days, that I may know how frail I am? Indeed, you have made my days as a handbreadth. It's like that, measured against something much longer. That's how long our lives are. And my age is nothing before you. Certainly, every man at his best state is but a vapor. You know what a vapor is? You walk out in the morning on a cold day and you go, and it's there for just a second, and then it's gone. Kids like to play that game. Sometimes even as adults we like to do that, like to watch our breath. That's a vapor. It's there for a moment and then it's gone. And David says, that's life. That's what it is for us. Surely every man walks about like a shadow. Surely they busy themselves in vain. He heaps up riches. That's what a lot of people pursue in life, material things. And he doesn't know who's going to spend it, because it probably won't be him. He'll leave it to somebody else who will have the pleasure of spending whatever it is that he could heap up. Now, Lord, what do I wait for? My hope is in you. That's the priority. We hope in God. That's really the only hope there is. And that is our hope as Christians. David struggled, and in this case, he succeeded in keeping the right perspective about life. There were times when he felt he had to bite his tongue to keep from saying something that he might regret later on when he saw things in a different light. And then he asked God, help me remember how temporary I am. Help me remember that I have certain things to accomplish in a very brief life. And that's what my focus needs to be. Psalm 118, before we leave the Psalms, let's look at another one. Psalm 118, which I think is a beautiful way of summing up a proper attitude for us to have. Psalm 118, verse 24. It says there, this is the day which the Lord has made. We will rejoice and be glad in it. Every day that we wake up in the morning, every day we draw breath, is a gift from God. He's made that day for us, and he's made us and given us the opportunity to experience life during that day. And all of the good things that we have in life, and we do have many good things. I know myself, as a human being, we all are, we tend much more easily to focus on the negative things, the things that bother us, as if there shouldn't be any of those things. Life should just be great from morning till evening. If we really start counting the blessings we have, the good things we have, compared to the things that really bother us, I believe you would find that you will find a lot more good things in your life than negative things. But it's easy for us to focus on the negatives. This is the day that the Lord has made. I will be thankful. I will rejoice in it and enjoy the time that we have to be able to think, to be able to plan for the future, to be able to enjoy the pleasures of our family and our mate and the other good things that God gives us in life. We should appreciate each day that we have. It is a gift. Literally, it's a gift from God. Now let's move forward a little bit farther into Ecclesiastes chapter 5 as we look at various passages that talk about how we should view our lives and the fact that they are temporary. Ecclesiastes chapter 9, starting in verse 5. Ecclesiastes 9, starting in verse 5. While the living know that they will die, the dead know nothing, and they have no more reward, for the memory of them is forgotten. Also, the thing that seems so important to them, the things that we get so wrapped up in and upset about, their love, their hatred, their envy, that's all perished. All the things that seem so important that occupy our thoughts throughout so much of our lives, I mean, that's all just going to end. And it's not going to seem important at all. Nevermore will they have a share in anything done under the sun. So go, eat your bread with joy, drink your wine with a merry heart, for God has already accepted your works. If you're living the right way of life, then that's pleasing to God, if you've got your priorities correct. Let your garments always be white. Let your head lack no oil. Take advantage of the physical comforts and pleasures that God makes available to us. And he really does make available a great deal. Just think about the pleasure it is to eat three times a day with a great variety of things. This is something I often see in Africa. First of all, they don't always eat three times a day. They're happy if they eat once a day. And many times it's boring because it's the same stuff over and over and over again. They eat the same staples. It's the same beans. It's the same tomatoes. It's the same onions over and over and over again. And I'm always happy to come home when I can eat something different every day. You know, it's just the variety. Those are little pleasures that we can take for granted that not everybody even has in this life. But there are pleasures and good things that God has given to us all the way through. And we should take advantage of them, really appreciate them, think about them. So eat your bread with joy, drink your wine with a merry heart. enjoy the good things of life. Verse 9, live joyfully with the wife whom you love all the days of your vain life. Solomon kept reminding us that if all we have is this life, it's in vain. There's not a lot of use that's going to come out of it. If this is all there is, Paul said, then we're really of all men most miserable, because this isn't really what it's about. So live joyfully with the wife whom you love all the days of your vain life, which he has given you under the sun, all your days of vanity, for that is your portion in life and in the labor which you perform under the sun. Then in verse 10, he says something that we should take to heart also. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might. For there is no work or device or knowledge or wisdom in the grave where, in case you missed it, you're going. That's where we're all going. So this is all going to come to an end someday. So whatever we do, do it with your might. And that implies a couple of things. That implies that if there's something that's not worth doing it with all our might, maybe it's not worth doing, or at least we should consider whether it truly is. The things that we are to be active in really are things that we should be able to throw ourselves into with all our hearts and all our minds. And it's going to mean something in the end. It's going to have some importance that will go on beyond this life. Appreciate the good things in life. Enjoy them. Live life to the full. But realize that life is like a vapor and that there must be something more. That's why as Christians we live our lives not only for the pleasures of this life, although we accept them and thank God for the ones that we have, but we have our eyes on a future life. Because if this is all there is, it's not going to end well for us. There is something more. Abraham Lincoln said, "In the end, it's not the years in your life that count. It's the life in your years." It's the life in your years. It's what you do with the time you have that counts more than the amount of time you get to live. And his life, of course, was cut short, and yet he did amazing things. He's still remembered as probably our greatest president, a man almost universally admired because of what he did with the time he had. And that is a lesson for us, too. It's a lesson for us. We only have so much time, so we need to make sure we're doing what's most important with the time that we have. There is a famous historic symbol that was intended by the ancients to express the concept of moderation. It was the symbol of a dolphin twisted around an anchor. And in fact, this was minted on Roman coins by Emperor Titus of the Roman Empire, a dolphin twisted around an anchor. It was meant to strike a balance between too much hurry and too much delay, the failure that comes from rushing in without premeditation, or the failure that comes from sitting by and watching an opportunity go by that we should have grasped. So the anchor represented the idea of delay, and the dolphin at the time was regarded as the swiftest of all the sea creatures. And you will still occasionally see that symbol used today. Some families in antiquity adopted it as a family crest, and often the text in Latin underneath it would be festina lente, hasten slowly, hasten slowly. Consider the proper balance in your life. Move at the appropriate pace. Make sure that you're not letting opportunities slip by you that are going to be important later on. But don't move so precipitously that you end up making mistakes. This is the right balance between haste and hesitation. And we need to live our lives in that kind of balance, too. A balanced life is a very important key to being successful. Think about what you're doing. And above all, we don't want to waste time on futilities. And you know, nowadays we have more futilities available to us than at any time in human history. I am struck when I travel, and you probably are as well, you'll see it even around your home, how much time people spend on their phones, on their screens. When I get on airplanes, and I do that a lot, more than I would like to sometimes, almost the first thing passengers do, almost all of them, as soon as they get their carry-on stored, they sit down. As soon as they sit down, out comes the phone, and they're going to check their messages until they have to turn it off. Or they're playing games. Now, I'm not surprised to see kids playing games, but I am a bit surprised to see adults of all ages playing games on their phones. Now, we all need to relax sometimes. I've been known to play an occasional game myself. I do that sometimes too. But the scale, the amount of time that people are wasting on empty activities like that is stunning. You may remember a couple of years ago I gave a Bible study at the Winter Family Weekend, and I titled it, What Do You Do With All Your Time? And I introduced it with a story about a lady from Africa who had come to visit us, and we had her over for dinner. This was her first time in the West. She was from Kenya. And so she, with my wife, while she was getting ready to prepare the meal, she was taking care of the things. And she was watching all the labor-saving devices that we have in an average American home, and our home was very average. She saw the refrigerator that could store enough food for weeks. So my wife doesn't have to go and shop every day like most women do in Africa because they don't have a refrigerator. She noticed the electric range. My wife didn't have to build a fire to cook anything. She just flipped a switch and it cooked. Not only that, there was even a microwave oven which could heat something up almost instantaneously in a matter of seconds. She was amazed. My wife got the vacuum cleaner out to give the rug a quick. She looked at that. She'd never seen that before. They have to carry the rugs outside, hang them over a rope, and beat them with a stick to get the dust out of them. She saw one labor-saving device after another. There was a garbage disposal. Turn it on. There it goes. You don't have to carry it outside. It just disappears. And I will share this story with you because she did as well. She noticed after the meal that my wife was putting the dishes in the dishwasher. She was very impressed by that. And she told my wife later on, she said, I'm going to have my husband build me one of those. She said, it's such a great idea. You can just take all the dirty dishes and hide them away from your guests. And then when they leave, you can take them out and wash them. She thought that was a great idea. And when my wife said, no, it's actually a machine that washes the dishes. Her jaw fell open. And that's when she asked my wife, at the end of this day of hanging around in an American kitchen, she said to my wife, what do you do with all your time? Because her time is taking up doing manually all those things that we can do automatically. That's a really good question. What do we do with all our time? You know the answer for many Americans? They waste it. It's entertainment time. They live to be entertained. Now, entertainment has its place, but is that really the most important thing that we should be doing with our time? Should we be spending hours every day on pretty much mindless entertainment? These are the kinds of questions we ask ourselves as we think about the fact that we have a limited amount of time on earth. Teach us to number our days. Mohandas Gandhi said, action expresses priorities. Action expresses priorities. When we choose to do something, it's an expression about something that's important to us or what motivates us. So what do we do? What kind of actions? What kind of priorities are expressed by the things that we do with the time that we have, especially the free time? And we really have more free time than in any other time in history. Are we doing something worthwhile with it? Or is it just wasted? That's a question that's good for us to think about. Ecclesiastes chapter 11. Ecclesiastes chapter 11, starting in verse 9. Rejoice, O young man, in your youth, and let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. Youth is a wonderful time. It's the time that we're indestructible. We can live on nothing but ramen noodles and 3 hours of sleep a night. That's what we choose to do. And our bodies will let us do it, right? You remember those days. We all remember, well, maybe you didn't do ramen noodles in those days, but pizza, whatever it was. We could live on junk food and not get sick, and we didn't have to sleep, and we could go like this for days and days. It's a wonderful time. And God gives us all of that energy and that seeming indestructibility. Let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. Walk in the ways of your heart. Youth is a time to discover the world and try out new things. Try out different options for the way we may want to live our lives later on. And in the sight of your eyes, discover the world. But know that for all this, God will bring you into judgment. Just like we heard about in the sermonette. We have freedom of speech, but our speech will be judged. We have freedom of activity, but our activity and our motivations will be judged as well. Therefore, remove sorrow from your heart, put away evil from your flesh, for childhood and youth are vanity. It's going to end. I remember when I was a young man, it seemed like 70 years. I was thinking about living 70 years. I thought, man, that is so long. That's a long time. I've got all the time in the world. You know what I figured out? That's not long at all. And the older we get, the more we realize, wow, this experience is going to be over before it began. This is going to go really fast. It does. It goes very fast. Ecclesiastes chapter 12, verse 13. Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. So this is Solomon cogitating on the purpose of life, basically the purpose of life apart from God. Can we find a way to live lives to be really happy apart from an afterlife and apart from God? This is the conclusion of the whole matter. No, you can't. You have to fear God. That's what gives the whole thing meaning. Fear God, keep his commandments. This is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every work into judgment, including every secret thing, whether it is good or whether it is evil. We need to live our lives in the light of that understanding. God is going to require that we give an explanation for why we use the time he gave us the way we did. And I've mentioned before, I think it would be a very sad thing for God, as we're trying to give account for what we did with our lives, it would be a shame for anybody to have to say to God, well, look, this is what I did. And for God to say, that's it? That's it? That's all you did? That's all you did with the time I gave you? I gave you lots of time. You should have been able to do more than that. You should have been able to do more. Now, this concept of using our lives appropriately to do the most important things that we have to do is, of course, carried over into the New Testament as well. 1 Corinthians chapter 15, for example. 1 Corinthians chapter 15. Verse 32, if in the manner of men I have fought with beasts at Ephesus, what advantage is it to me? That is, if there's no resurrection, if there's no afterlife, if we're not working towards something that goes beyond this physical life that we have, then what good is it to go to accomplish great exploits in this life? If the dead do not rise, let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die. There's really nothing more to it. If there is no resurrection, if there is no reward that's coming because we've lived our lives appropriately and accomplished the most important things, then we may as well just eat and drink and party down, like they would say today, because that's all there is. And there's nothing but a hole in the ground at the end of it. Matthew chapter 7. Matthew chapter 7, verse 24. Matthew 7, verse 24. Therefore, whoever hears these sayings of mine and does them, I will liken him to a wise man who built his house on the rock. And the rain descended, and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat on that house, and it did not fall, for it was founded on the rock. Now, everyone who hears these sayings of mine and does not do them will be like a foolish man who built his house on the sand. And the rain descended, and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat on that house, and it fell. And great was its fall. So it was when Jesus had ended these sayings that the people were astonished at his teaching, for he taught them as one having authority and not as the scribes. This comes with the authority of God behind it. We can build on a rock or we can build on sand. We can use our lives to accomplish what's important in God's sight, or we can do something else with it, whatever seems important to us at the time. And that is equated to building our house on the sand, and it's not going to last in that case. So, what do we seek to do? The question we all have to ask. I would like to mention at this point, I see a lot of silver hair out in this congregation. We have a lot of old-timers here who've been faithful in the Church of God for many years. I remember some of you when I was a boy in shorts. And I would just like to say that your examples, to those of us who are maybe a generation or half a generation behind, your examples have been extremely and are extremely encouraging to us, because we have watched you build your houses on the rock. And we have watched you be faithful and number your days throughout your lives to accomplish those things which are most important. And I just would like to thank you for the examples that you have set, because they are noted and they are very much appreciated. 2 Corinthians chapter 4. 2 Corinthians chapter 4. Starting in verse 16. 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 16. Therefore, we do not lose heart. And sometimes that's not as easy as it sounds. We might lose heart with the difficult trials and painful things that sometimes are our lot in life. Those things happen. We don't lose heart, even though our outward man is perishing, and that is the lot of all flesh, yet the inward man is being renewed day by day. We're getting stronger spiritually. There's a renewal, a spiritual renewal that God is watching over and taking care of in us. For our light affliction, well, I'll be the first to say it doesn't always feel that way, does it? Sometimes it feels a lot heavier than light. But when we're looking in the context of eternity and what God's doing with us, any affliction that we have in this life, as we look back on it, is going to seem light. Our light affliction, which is but for a moment. Again, it doesn't always seem that way to us. It seems like some of our trials go on and on and on and on. But in the great scheme of eternity, when we look back on it, we're going to say, boy, that was just a snap of fingers. That went by so quickly. It is but for a moment, and it is working for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory. An eternal weight of glory. We go through some difficult things in this life, but they're very short compared to the eternity that we have ahead of us. That's a struggle for us to keep that perspective. Not easy, I know myself, but that is the perspective the Bible encourages us to take. And that was the perspective that the men of God who wrote the Bible had in their minds as well. Teach us to number our days. David said, make me to know the end of my days. They wanted to focus on what was really important with the time that they had. Verse 18, while we do not look at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. That's our focus. The things which are seen are temporary. All the things that can seem so important to us in this life, the things we can see and touch and taste, they're temporary. They're going to go away. One day they will no longer exist. But the things which are not seen are eternal. And that's what God is developing in us when we participate with Him and we submit ourselves to Him. Perishing outwardly, but growing stronger inwardly. And we're heading toward an eternal weight of glory, it says. John, in 1 John chapter 2, put it a little bit differently, but he said something very similar. 1 John chapter 2. First John chapter 2, verse 15. Do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. If these are number one priorities, then we're not really guided by loving God. For all that is in the world, and John sums it up in three things. All that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life, is not of the Father, but is of the world. And this is why it's important to notice this, to understand this. The world is passing away. And the lust of it, the things that seem so important to people now, that they will live their lives in pursuit of them, they're passing away. It's temporary. It's going to disappear. But he who does the will of God abides forever. Forever. There will not be an end to it. Let me make a couple of suggestions of things that you might want to mull over if you want to think back on the sermon during the week or tonight or tomorrow, if you do things like that, review your notes. A couple of things to consider in light of what we've seen in these passages about the brevity of life. Your marriage. Do you appreciate the marriage that you have? The love, the appreciation, the companionship, the sharing that you have with a mate? The wife of your youth or the husband of your youth, that's something that should be taken very seriously and appreciated. It should be something that we count as a blessing every day. We read in Ecclesiastes 9:9, live joyfully with the wife whom you love all the days of your vain life, because this is your lot. One of the best things God has given us are the mates that we can have. Enjoy that. Take advantage of it and be thankful for it. Your children. You think about what a blessing it is to have your children. Are you teaching them the things that they need to know about life? You can really help them out if you teach them things. But it takes a conscious effort. It doesn't won't happen automatically. Some things happen automatically. Some things they'll learn by watching our examples. But there is a need for actual teaching as well, to teach them things about the Bible, the spiritual foundation, but just life skills. Those are things we should be doing to equip our children. Ephesians 6, verse 4 tells fathers not to provoke their children to wrath, but to bring them up in the training and admonition of the Lord. So we have a responsibility as parents to teach our children. What about your friends? Do you appreciate the friendships that you have? Are you aware of how valuable and pleasant those friendships are in your life? Let me quote Proverbs 29, verse 7. It says, "Ointment and perfume delight the heart, and the sweetness of a man's friend gives delight by hearty counsel." To have a good conversation with a friend, maybe it's here at church, or maybe it's other friends that you have, that is really one of the high points of life. It's one of the great joys of life. It's something that we should relish and of which we should be aware. We should be thankful for that. More famously than Proverbs 27:9 is verse 17 of Proverbs 27 that says, "As iron sharpens iron, so a man sharpens the countenance of his friend." I'm very thankful in my life to have good friends with whom I can have good, meaty, useful conversations. And I come away happier and more enriched from having had them. And I'm sure you have friends like that as well. Enjoy them. Take advantage of those friendships. Appreciate them for all they're worth. Your friends are something you should think about in the light of the brevity of life. And I'll also mention our commitment and our participation in the life of the Church of God. That is something that's important in God's eyes, and it should be important in our eyes as well. Now, there were times in the past we had to learn some balance on this. We had to learn our festina lente even in the Church of God. And there were sometimes people who served too much in the church and maybe weren't as present in their families as much as they could have been. Sometimes the pendulum can swing in the other direction. And we sometimes see that a little bit today where people just kind of disengage. They're older, they're tired, and you know, it takes more of an effort to really participate fully. And so sometimes people don't, or not as much as perhaps they would have in the past. And I realize there are always health issues involved. Sometimes it's not a question of whether we want to, it's a question of whether we physically can or not. But it is a good question for us to think about, our commitment and our participation in the life and the work of the church. Hebrews chapter 10. Hebrews chapter 10, 23 to 25. "Let us hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering, for he who promised is faithful." There's a risk of wavering, apparently. We're encouraged not to do that. Don't waver. And if the Bible encourages us not to do something, it means there will be times we may be tempted to do it. So hold fast to the confession of our hope without wavering. "And let us consider one another in order to stir up love and good works." That's part of church. Church is not just coming and hearing a sermon. I've sometimes heard people of different ages actually say, "Oh, you know, church is far away, and I can just stay home and listen to a good sermon. There's so many available out there." And I usually tell people, well, you know, church is more than the sermon. The holy convocation is not just about the sermon. It's about the fellowship. We owe each other to stir each other up to love and good works. That's a responsibility I have to you and you have to me, that we have to each other. It's something we owe each other in the body of Christ, to consider one another and to stir each other up to love and good works, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together, as is the manner of some, but exhorting one another. That means encouraging one another. We all need encouragement. I remember asking my dad when I started out as a very young minister, ordained probably younger than I should have been. That's the way we did it in those days. The needs were so great. And I said, "Dad, give me some advice. You've been doing this a long time. Give me some advice to help me as a very young, inexperienced minister." And he told me, he said, "You know what I found over the years is what people need most is encouragement. What church members need most is encouragement." And I've never forgotten that. And I always try to make it an effort whenever I have the chance to preach or teach or write. I try to make sure that there's encouragement in there. And we really have that responsibility to each other. We need to be encouraging one another. Not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together as the manner of some, but exhorting one another, encouraging one another, and so much more as you see the day approaching. As you see the day approaching. Do you see the day approaching? When you watch what's going on in the news these days, I dare say we are seeing that day approaching. I'm not giving you any dates or years or whatever, but is it approaching? Oh yeah, it is definitely approaching. Look at another interesting passage with me in Malachi chapter 3. Malachi chapter 3, starting in verse 13. This is fascinating to me because this shows that some things that occur in the lives of God's people are really timeless. You can go back to the time of Malachi, 400-ish BC, and some of the attitudes will be similar to things that we sometimes see today. Malachi chapter 3, verse 13. God says, "Your words have been harsh against me," says the Lord. So some of the Jews at the time were saying hard things about God. Their words were harsh against him. They were critical of the way God was working things out. It didn't seem fair to them, or they thought it should be done a different way. And they were critical of God. "Yet you say, what have we spoken against you? You have said, it is vain to serve God. I've been doing this for so long, where's the reward?" The dirty, rotten scoundrel is getting rewarded, the one we talked about earlier. He's getting the reward, and I'm not. It's in vain to serve God. Where's my reward? It's vain to serve God. What profit is it that we have kept his ordinances and that we have walked as mourners before the Lord of hosts? So now we call the proud blessed, and those who do wickedness are raised up. Yes, those who tempt God go free. It seems that way sometimes, doesn't it? It seems that way. Verse 16, "Then those who feared the Lord spoke to one another." What did they speak to one another about? Well, if they feared the Lord, they were speaking good things about God, about his blessings. And they were encouraging one another and exhorting one another as they saw the day approaching. They spoke to one another and the Lord listened. I don't know if you've ever thought about that or not, but when you're fellowshipping here in the congregation, God's listening in. He's paying attention. And when you have conversations with friends and you share some encouragement with someone, a brother or sister in the church, God's listening in. Not only does he listen, a book of remembrance was written before him. He's keeping score. Now, the good thing about the way God keeps score is when we foul up and we repent, that gets erased. But what goes on the positive side of the ledger, that stays. And he never, ever forgets it. So that's a good kind of ledger, wouldn't you say? You look at the ledger, okay, on the debit side, oh, there's nothing there. It's all been forgiven through the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. What's on the positive side? Whoa, there's a long list of things that you did, and I remember every one of them. That's what it indicates to me here. Isn't that what it looks like? "The Lord listened and heard them, so a book of remembrance was written before him for those who fear the Lord and who meditate on his name." Verse 17, "They shall be mine, says the Lord of hosts, on the day that I make them my jewels." That's a day yet to come. And what a wonderful day that is going to be. What a wonderful day that's going to be. So what we're seeing here is that we're not supposed to walk by sight. We're supposed to walk by faith. We're not supposed to walk and be consumed by the things that we can see. We're supposed to be occupied by pursuing the things that we cannot see. And our Father says he's very aware of what we do for him. And that includes our family life. That includes our service to our brethren and service in the church. Young or old, because of what's going on in the world, sometimes our enthusiasm can dim. But we need to remember that we have a lot we can give to one another. And we're responsible to one another. We really owe it to each other to do as much as we can. I sometimes, as a pastor, and I'm not really actively pastoring exactly now because I'm serving so many people all over the place that it's not like being a local pastor anymore, but I have done that in the past. And so I've sometimes sat with church members in what we might call the autumn of their lives, either because they're ill or they're just getting very old. And I've done that in hospital rooms. I've done it in living rooms. Sometimes it's been in the church, the hall of the congregation. And I listen to them. I listen to them as they sort of go back over their lives, and they're considering it. What have I accomplished? What am I going to leave behind? And I've never heard anyone lament that they didn't make more money, or that they didn't have a bigger house, or that they hadn't made one more trip to some exotic location. I've never heard anybody lament that or wish that they had done that. But I have sometimes heard people lament that they didn't spend more time with their loved ones, or that they had wasted time. I wasted so much time. And that, I try to encourage them and help them see the perspective and all that. As long as we're pursuing what is most important first, then God is very understanding about our physical weaknesses and our lack of attention to certain things. As long as we're seeking first the kingdom of God and his righteousness. But I have heard a number of people lament the fact that they just wasted a lot of time. They could have done so much more with the time that they had. This is the first time I've ever quoted Mae West in a sermon. But Mae West said, "You only live once, but if you do it right, once is enough." She's right, but not in the way she thinks she was. Would you agree that that's true? We only live once, and that's the way God set it up. We only live once in the flesh like this, knowing God. But if we do it right, once is enough to prepare us for eternity. That's the way God has set it up for his people. We only live once, but if we do it right, that once will be enough to prepare us for life in the kingdom of God throughout all eternity. So, do we have goals? Do we have goals in life? I believe we should have goals in life. Now, this will vary according to the phase of life where we are, but we should have some physical goals, especially if we're younger, goals that we set for ourselves. Proverbs 21, verse 5 says, "The plans of the diligent lead surely to plenty, but those of everyone who is hasty, sure to poverty." Proverbs 21, verse 5. We should have plans, and we should be diligent about them. So we should have physical goals that we seek. Again, depending on where we are in life, setting aside money for retirement, something you want to accomplish in life, a trip you want to make, the book you want to write, whatever it might be. What are you waiting for? If you haven't started on it, if you've not made a list of goals, and you're not pursuing them actively right now, what are you waiting for? Time's a-wasting, literally. Make a list. Make a list. Write them down. Short-term goals, medium-term goals, long-term goals. If you don't write them down, if you don't have a list of goals, you won't attain them. Do you have, we all should, spiritual goals? Do we have spiritual goals? The Bible encourages us to have priorities and goals of a spiritual nature. Remember we read, seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and the physical things will sort themselves out. All these other things will be added unto you. So we should have spiritual goals. Now sometimes it's easy for us to think, because spiritual things are sort of intangible, you can't really measure them or whatever, we think, well, I can't really have anything too concrete. It's just going to be sort of amorphous because I can't really, how do you measure, love, or how do you measure this or that? Well, you can't measure it in a measuring cup, but we can see when there's growth, can we not? We can see when we're improving. We can see when we're growing in patience. We can know that we have a better understanding of the Bible after the amount of time that we've spent studying it and reading it. We can see that we're growing in wisdom. Sometimes we'll find out when other people tell us, boy, you're a lot more patient than you were before. That's growth. Or I can really see that you deepened in compassion, or the understanding that you expressed in our conversation about that passage of the Bible was very helpful to me. We get indications that there is spiritual growth. There are concrete goals that we can set for ourselves to attain spiritual goals based on what the Bible gives us. Concentrate on the fruit of the Spirit. Concentrate on other lists of things that the Bible gives us, and set specific goals for yourself. I want to do better in this. If you don't know what you need to do better in, ask your wife or a friend. I'm only half joking when I say that. She'll tell you. He'll tell you, right? Sometimes it's good to have another perspective on these things. Last passage in James chapter 4. James chapter 4. I've learned that there is miraculous power in those words. One last passage. Increases the alertness level in the congregation. James chapter 4, verse 13. Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we will go to such and such a city, spend a year there, buy and sell, and make a profit. We've got big plans for what we're going to do in life. Whereas you do not know what will happen tomorrow. For what is your life? It is even a vapor. Where have we heard that before? That appears for a little time and then vanishes away. We do need to make plans, but we need to understand that any plans that we make are subordinate to God's plan for our lives. And that is as it should be. We wouldn't want it any other way. His plan for our lives is the best thing that could occur in our lives. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, if it's God's will, if he grants me life to do it, then I'll be able to carry on and pursue these goals that I have. If the Lord wills, we shall live and do this or that. But now all you boast in your arrogance, and such boasting is evil. Therefore, to him who knows to do good and does not do it, to him it is a sin. Don't put off the things that you need to be doing. Don't put off the things that need to be done. Don't put it off. Don't even put it off till tomorrow. If you know that there are things you should be pursuing and you're not, start today. Time's a-wasting. It truly is. Or it will if we allow it to. Get going on things we need to do right away. It's important for us to live each day as a precious gift from God, because as each day goes by, we will never have that day back again. Yesterday is over, it's gone. We'll never have those 24 hours again to do a do-over. We get each day once, and we need to make it worth it. What would happen? How would you live your life differently if you suddenly found out you only had a short time to live? Would you make changes in your life? Well, I hate to break it to you, but you do only have a short time to live. Even the young people here, in the great scheme of things, we only have a short time to live. And as I said, the older we get, the more we realize what a short time it truly is. But what we do with the time that we have during the time of our vapor here on the earth echoes, in fact, determines to a certain extent what's going to happen in eternity. So each day that we have is vitally important. We can call it live like you were dying, like Tim McGraw did. But whatever we call it, I encourage you to ask God to help you number your days and to understand the end of your life, the goal of your life. Because whether we meditate on that or not, whether we meditate on the fact that our days are numbered, it doesn't change the fact that they are, in fact, numbered. And we have very important things to accomplish with our days on earth. So, brethren, let's make every day count.